Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Someone said recently that if there is a war on drugs in this country, then we are not winning it. Ever since Richard Nixon declared that war, law enforcement at all levels has been engaged in that battle. Narco-terrorism has taken production and distribution to a new level and put a lot of illicit product in our own backyard. Heroin has made a big comeback. Cocaine, still a major problem. Meth is a scourge. One of the soldiers in the war is a veteran DEA agent who spent some three decades fighting the fight, most of it undercover. He's St. Louis native Edward Follis, and he's written a book on his career titled The Dark Art, My Undercover Life in Global Narco-Terrorism, co-authored by Douglas Sentry. Ed Follis joins us to talk about the war and his role in it. Congratulations on surviving. One heck of a career. I mean, some of the stories you tell in the book are really quite remarkable.
Well, thank you. And, yeah, you know, and especially after writing the book, I've realized, you know, I don't even know how many times, you know, I was blessed with just making it, and now I'm back in St. Louis, you know?
And it's a totally different world for you, given the places you've been all over the world, dealing with the worst of the worst in the illicit drug trade.
That is very true. You know, in Bangkok, where I lived for quite a while, and Mexico and Ciudad Juarez and Kabul, Afghanistan, you know, I didn't have to look at the signs. I knew where I was driving. But trying to find your studio today was a bit of a challenge for me.
Well, the places you were driving and those locations that you just mentioned were taking you to some pretty dangerous folks, weren't they?
Yeah. And the book was cathartic that I – finally look back on all those days and all the stuff that, you know, I did, especially in the narco-terrorism world. I testified on two occasions as a subject matter. I'm still the only subject matter expert on a specific law that Congress passed, and not, you know, the prolonger, but it was called the 960A law, and it allows DEA to pursued narco-traffickers for purposes of national security, and the allowances given are very, very, very good, and we use that. And you know, I became the guy that was principally the major benefactor of all that.
What sort of allowances are you talking about?
Well, the statute itself is not very thick, and the proof of evidence just fundamentally says that those who intend on forwarding drugs and proceeds in advancement of a narco-terrorist agenda, they can be very, very, very quickly prosecuted. So we brought a lot of people from Afghanistan back here and you know.
So it gives you, as an agent, a lot of leeway in going after these folks and bringing them back and prosecuting. Before we get to some of the specifics about your book, I'm going to mention three words to you, which you've already heard here this afternoon, and get reaction to them. I know it, having read the book, but I want our audience to hear what you think about war on drugs.
The war on drugs is somewhat like a number of other wars that we've advanced since Vietnam. And I'm not quite sure that we're pressing in as hard as we should. I did, personally, you know, as an agent. But the war on drugs has to focus emphatically on the larger figures. And that's what I did my whole life. And that's what the book talks about. I never pursued people that were addicted. I think they're not victims, but they are in need of extreme assistance. It's those who exploit them, and those are the people. For some reason, God gave me the ability to be able to meet all these people and talk to them and convince them basically to throw up their lives. But they're not concerned about the addicts and the people that are, you know, hopelessly addicted. Like, you know, methamphetamine has been a major scourge in Missouri, and it's fueled wholly by these, you know, major CEOs.
Well, yeah, they are entrepreneurs at the highest level, are they not? And
yes, sir.
More often than not, they are billionaires. And sometimes they're governments. I was surprised to learn. We've heard a lot about meth in Missouri, as you've indicated. I was surprised to learn that North Korea has such a heavy and heavy-handed role in the meth world.
Absolutely. When I was in Los Angeles, I was the associate special agent in charge. So I had about 850 people at that time. And one of our, you know, major engagements was methamphetamine. So I had Saipan and Guam and that whole area in the Pacific flooded with pseudoephedrine and methamphetamine from North Korea. I went and did some work there. And, it's just, you know, heroin and methamphetamine steals souls. And you see the poor people that are just wholly addicted. And, you know, the only way to do this is to take, like, Maslow's pyramid, turn it upside down, mm-hmm. right, and start at the top. You don't start at the bottom.
I had a note here with regard to that. That obviously is a big part of your book, is going after the big guys. But you say, no matter how good an agent, no matter how big the cases, you could never seize enough drugs to make a difference.
Yeah, the appetite is too strong. Mm-hmm. And when I was honored to work with Oliver Stone with the movie Savages, that became explicitly clear in the script that was, you know, assembled and that we were able to portray. The appetite's too strong. The only way to do it is to go to the top of the Hydra. You got to go there. You got to take them out. And that's really important.
Well, as you've indicated, that's what you did. That's what you spent a large portion of your career doing.
Yes, sir.
How do you get close to these guys? They're insulated. They're isolated. They're protected. I mean, in every sense of the word, these guys have got to be hard to reach, except for those that they want to reach them. And here is, you know, Eddie Follis from St. Louis, Missouri, walking into a drug kingpin's lair and getting the goods on him.
Number one, beyond anything else, you have to have the right access, and that's through informants, of course, because they already have standing with these people. And then number two, you have to be like them. And, you know, once they trust you, they don't want to disbelieve their trust in you. And when you're engaged with them and you've stepped into their world, I mean, even today I have guys that call me, you know, from jail, you know, because they just don't want to believe that it happened. So, you know, it's a matter of persona. It's a matter of taking your will and yourself and placing it into their world. And then once you get into their world, they want to trust you.
If you would, Ed, give me an example, any one of the cases that you represent in your book, but give me an example of how you move from, again, Eddie Follis from St. Louis into this world, the steps that you took. You informants, you got close to them, and then tell me a story.
Actually, I think one that's very pertinent to today is the Haji Juma Khan case. Mm-hmm. And
HJK, you called him.
Yeah. And that's almost like a love story, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I was in Afghanistan. I was in charge of our office there. And so I found three people that knew him, and they introduced me to him, and he started to trust me. And I myself actually had melanoma. Mm-hmm. He did too. So we, as you know from the book, we flew him to Washington, D.C., treated him like a celebrity, and the trust factor was huge. And I gave him phones, you know, I said, here, I'm going to be calling you sometime soon. So about a year and a half later, when we finally were able to assemble our indictment on him, because there was not much interest in Afghanistan until 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. Our focus was mm-hmm. Colombia and Thailand.
Yeah.
And so we took that message on, and sure enough, you know, about a year and a half later, he called me, and I talked to him every day, for like 60 days. And we had the indictment out of New York, and I said, meet me here. And I said, let's meet in Bangkok. He said, oh, no, you know this guy, Victor Boot. Remember him?
Mm-hmm. He was the Russian arms dealer, right?
Yeah, and he was a major figure in the whole Russian ordeal. And he said, nah, it's not safe. I said, okay. I said, let's go to Malaysia. You know, we can eat kebabs and hang out and all that. Mm. And then I said, how about Jakarta? So, you know, here's a man, billionaire, mm-hmm. and he decided to meet me in Jakarta for purposes of reestablishing relationship because he thought I was en route to Iran to be a new DE agent there, and he had incredible connections there. So the story is very, very compelling. He, we ticket flew to Dubai, had to take him and put him in a place where, you know, nothing would happen to him, and then he got on the plane and he flew down to Jakarta, and that's where I got him.
This is when he knew you were a DEA agent.
Yeah.
But the initial representation with him, you were something else. What were you when you first met him? Who did he think you were? What did he think you were?
He thought that I was associated, obviously, with the embassy, you know, in Kabul. But he didn't fully grasp a lot of, you know, what I was doing there. And then he didn't think that I was dirty or bad or, you know, corrupt or anything like that. He just thought that I was engaging him to advance, you know, my career. Mm-hmm. And that's what I told him. I said, I'm going to Iran. I said, I need you. He said, what do you want me to do? I said, well, let's meet there, you know. So it's not a one-day proposition. It takes many days, and you actually have to invest yourself into these people because they actually are giving up their lives when they trust you this much.
Yeah. Well, you're doing the same. I mean, if you are found out in the midst of this circle.
Done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just that simple. How close do you think you came at any time to being done?
Oh, several times. You know, but back then, you know, you just drive hard and you don't think about those matters of, you know, being done like that. I mean,
maybe you don't, Ed. I can assure you I would.
Well, Mexico was unbelievable.
Let's talk about that in a moment. I have to take
sure.
a break. We'll do that now.
Yes,
we'll come back and talk about Mexico because lots going on there now and lots been going on for a long time. Our guest is Ed Follis. The book is The Dark Art, and it's subtitled My Undercover Life in Global Narco-Terrorism. It's a life that Ed Follis lived for almost 3 decades. He's out of it now, but the life is going to return on film, as I understand it. You heard the mention of Oliver Stone a little while ago. We'll talk about that, too. And if you'd like to get into the conversation, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send a tweet, do that at STL On Air. Back with Ed Follis in just a moment. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back as we continue our conversation with Ed Follis. He is the author of The Dark Art. He's a former undercover agent for the Drug Enforcement Administration and was so for about 30 years. As I say, the book is The Dark Art, and it's all of his exploits over that time are certainly the most dramatic ones, and all of them are, in fact, dramatic. Ed, before the break, you mentioned Mexico, and of course, that is so much in the news these days, the drug cartels, the disappearance of school children and the murders, it just keeps happening and happening. Give me some sense of what your involvement in Mexico was, how you became involved in that part of the drug story.
When I was transferred from Bangkok to Texas, I was sent to El Paso. And
right across from Juarez.
That's quite a dichotomy. You drive down the highway on the 10 there, and you look at the right, and you see absolute impoverished world. And you look to the left, and there's, you know, the metropolis, so to speak, of El Paso. And so I arrived, and I wasn't about to get involved in the retail game. So I went after the wholesale game, and that was Amado Carrillo Fuentes and Vicente Carrillo Fuentes and his underlings in Juarez. And they were absolutely ruthless. And so pursued them, and we indicted them. And then thereafter, we were able to, pursue ill-gotten gains and all that kind of stuff. But what was most important, though, is the day that Amado Carrillo Fuentes died. And this is kind of not a goofy story, but I was riding my Harley from North Carolina to El Paso, and I received a call, and I went underneath this bridge, because it was raining. And then I received the call myself that Amado had died. And Amado died at the hands of inept doctors and anesthesiologists. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, imagine being one of the richest men around the world. Mm-hmm. And he went down like that. And I was in the car, And to some degree, there was satisfaction because I knew how bad this guy was. I mean, he was the lord of the skies. He developed a whole new paradigm for drug trafficking. He took the Colombians and said, look, I don't want your money. Pay me in product. And what he did is he took over everything west of the Mississippi. Mm. And that's why the Mexican cartel now, well, federation, I should say, is in total control west of the Mississippi. It's brilliance. These guys are, like you said earlier, entrepreneurs and CEOs of the highest extreme. So I said, nah, we got to do this guy. And so there I was under that bridge, right? And I'm in a car, my Harley, and there was an abandoned car. So I stepped into the abandoned car, just to get out of the rain. And I was listening to the phone, speaking to everybody when he was killed. And we pushed him so hard, he had to go into an ambulance that was opulent, but it looked on the outside like it was just ordinary. And then he went and had, major liposuction, and he was changing his appearance to his face and so forth because he knew we were going to get him. And I was laying there in the car thinking, oh, my gosh, he's dead. And I looked over, and there was a snake in the car. Oh. Boom, blasted it. It's a long story to cut short, but Amado was a student of the original Federation. And those were people from Guadalajara who were involved in the death of Kiki Camarena. In fact, they orchestrated it.
And let's explain to the audience who Kiki Camarena was. He was also an agent, undercover.
Yes, sir.
Murdered, brutally so. I mean, not that all murder isn't brutal, but he was pretty badly chopped up, if I recall, was he not? And
put in the
back of a truck or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they always call up, in Mexico they call them shallow graves because the ground is so hard there. Yeah. They don't dig too deep. And he was placed in it. He was a courageous, great man who served our country.
Well, this could have been you. I mean, he was living the life that you were living on a somewhat different level.
I know, but I was lucky. I made it, I told my mom the other day, I just made it.
in your book, you suggest, or others have just suggested, and you reported that there was some feeling that the CIA might have been in on that somehow.
Well, it's very clear that many of the individuals involved in that that whole conspiracy, were associated, but fingers touch everything. So there's just there's just no doubt. I mean, we know, in fact, Elaine Shannon, who's a brilliant, you know, author and worked for Time magazine and so forth, you know, she even reported, I mean, we know without consequence that the interrogations of Enrique were tape recorded. And when I was in Los Angeles, I know this sounds stranger than fiction, but fact always is better than fiction. We reopened the case on the murders of Enrique.
Who is Enrique now? Is that
Enrique Camarena? Kiki.
Oh, Kiki. Okay, yeah. I hadn't heard that name. Kiki Camarena. No,
yeah.
Enrique. No.
So.
Okay,
yeah. Go ahead. So we opened the investigation again, and there were 16 indictees, and four of them had never been brought to justice. So we pushed hard, and they were living in the Canary Islands. They were living all over the place, and we put them to the test. And all of them said, you know, without reservation, that you know they were moving along with handlers, and
handlers being pretend CIA, is that what we're saying?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Yeah, and how why would they be handling them? What were they infiltrating as well?
You know, many of those figures did quite a bit during the Sandinista and Contra engagements.
In which we were involved. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And as a result, you know, these unholy alliances were occurring. And not that they were aiding and abetting, you know, in trafficking, but you know, if you want to go to where those this is what I said in the book and what I say all the time. If you want to hunt elephants, you have to go where elephants live. Mm. And they, you know, took national security to a higher level, you know.
So that basically is what they were up to. It was a national security issue. They were infiltrating. They were working perhaps with these folks because there was an advantage to our national security.
I mean, absolutely.
The effort was for a noble purpose, I guess. Is that what we're saying?
Yes, it was absolutely noble. Yeah. And what I also say all the time is you can walk up and dance with the devil, but don't go home with the devil that night, mm-hmm. you know? And that's just the fundamentals that you have to deal with when you're engaged right now. And this is what we're doing right now with, you know, ISIS over in Iraq. And
how are we doing that with ISIS?
Well, you know, it went from ISIS to Levant, and now it's IS. I think we're doing very well. You know, they themselves as well have started a big drug portfolio. You know, they're brilliant. These guys are really smart guys. They have 6 to 7 different elements.
When you say we're doing well with them, are you suggesting that we're infiltrating this organization as well? Is that your feeling?
Well, I know, you know, without equivocation that in Aleppo, you know, they took over several chemical plants, and now they're producing the precursor chemicals for methamphetamine. And that's to feed the guys that are, you know, on the battlefield because it keeps them moving along, and then as well as for regional distribution. So now they've taken on, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you know, they do hostages, the kidnapping, just like it's the model of Mexico brought over there.
And that's another of our interests is getting at their drug production capabilities.
It's all about following the money. Mm-hmm. The only way you're going to beat these narco terrorists is take their funds away from them. Because without that, they have nothing.
Mm-hmm. We have a number of callers. I have many questions.
Yes, sir.
But they do too. So let's start with them, and we'll begin with Zach calling from St. Louis. Zach, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Quite a fascinating career. It's totally crazy to imagine what you've probably been through. I'd just like to know how deep you ever got in drug use yourself, you know, being with such a long career in that field. And then also on a side note, you know, battling all these, you know, drug lords and everybody else in your career, what do you think about all the states legalizing marijuana after fighting all of this for so long? I'd like to hear your opinion on that, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. Number one, I never took, you know, any drugs because I always dealt at a level where the people with whom I was engaging didn't take drugs. Think about it. If you're a CEO, do you drink five martinis before you enter into a business transaction? Of course not. So, no, there was never an occasion that I took drugs. And you don't have to. It's the will of personality that makes all this happen with these guys. On your second question, you know, I believe in the will of the people, okay? And I think that, you know, people have voted considerably and, you know, there's been movements toward that legalization. You cannot legalize drugs without regulation, right? You go to the doctor. The pharmacy gives you your pills, and it has to be regulated in terms of the psychotropic stuff that happens to you. I don't know. In fact, I think if legalization occurred, and it is occurring, but remember, federally, it's still illegal. I think that I know that if people are able to access drugs, you know, psychotropic drugs through a legal system, the black market and, you know, the underpinnings of all that will still produce hyper strong products that will be more attractive and less expensive than what would occur if it was legalized. So, you know, legalization or any sort of regulation is going to be a tough deal with that stuff because, you know, you don't have somebody driving a bus or flying a jet, you know, or, you know, airline pilot or, you know, school teacher on that kind of stuff because it's just too detrimental. So
one of the offshoots of the legalization in Colorado has been the fact they're making candy and pastry, brownies and what have you using marijuana, and that kids are getting a hold of these candies. I mean, young kids, infants, 3 years old, eating these candies, and it's having really very, very negative consequences in that way.
Right. You know, it's hard to study in school when you're high on THC, right, marijuana.
Yeah, well.
When I arrived in Los Angeles from Afghanistan, there were like 112, I can't remember exactly, marijuana dispensaries there. Then when I left, there were more marijuana dispensaries there than Starbucks. I mean,
that's saying something.
Yeah.
That's saying something. Another call. Tom in Webster Groves, go ahead. You're on the air with Ed Follis.
Thank you, Don. About 3 years ago, my family lost my younger brother to a heroin overdose.
Mm.
And, of course, in this area, the drug dealer can be charged with murder when that occurs. But
yes,
there was no investigation. And you just feel really powerless. You know, they say we have a heroin epidemic right now. And what I'd like to ask Ed is, you know, you have, you know, the FBI making deals with Whitey Bulger over the years and working with him and all these allegations of the CIA being involved in heroin trade. And I really would like to believe that the DEA is an organization that has integrity.
Yes.
And isn't as corrupt as at least it seems like some parts of those other organizations are. Can you reassure us that that somebody in law enforcement is really doing a good job to protect our, you know, the kind of people who are vulnerable to that stuff and do something about it?
You know, I can tell you that I was a part of that for 31 years. And an organization with greater integrity, I do not know. And DEA is an elite organization that has a single mission. And there's an internal introspective organization within DEA that monitors and follows and ensures that indeed that we pursue the right paths. Drug testing every 3 to 6 months. Conversations that are, everything's documented. Like I said, you want to get somebody nervous from other agencies, put them on the stand. But, we live for the stand to be there in court, and everything is scrutinized. So, yes, thank you for saying that, and I can assure you, and I wouldn't say this if I didn't mean it, yes, indeed, there's an incredible integrity with the DEA.
Thank you, Tom, for your call. I have to take another break now. We are talking with Ed Follis, who is the author of The Dark Art, which is subtitled My Undercover Life in Global Narco-Terrorism. We'll continue our conversation, take more of your calls when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Ed Follis, who is a now retired member of the Drug Enforcement Administration, spent most of his 30 years or so with the agency as undercover. But we'll continue that conversation after I give you some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Missouri State Board of Education has been reviewing applicants for a new commissioner of elementary and secondary education and has narrowed its field of candidates to 3. Whoever is selected will replace outgoing State Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro. Our reporters will take a look at the top contenders and their prospects for winning the position. And the U.S. Department of Justice unveiled new rules that will ban or nearly ban racial profiling by race, gender, religion, or sexual orientation. These rules apply to the FBI, DEA, and other federal agencies. What these new rules mean for area law enforcement and its approach to racial profiling has yet to be determined. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Ed Follis. Ed, picking up on the news headlines I just read, racial profiling, it seems to me, would have to be present in the work that the DEA does. I mean, I would think that would be a big part of it. What about the notion of eliminating that potential from your investigative process?
I believe that, racial should be erased from the vocabulary. The manner in which DEA is stunningly successful is just pure investigations. It has nothing to do with someone's pigmentation. It just doesn't.
Unless it's part of a description, right?
Yeah.
If you're said to chase a man wearing a green suit and a red hat, you're going to use that to track down that person. Or if you're said he's a black man, wearing a green suit and a red hat, that becomes part of it.
Yes. It's a process. One must develop reasonable suspicion, then the probable cause. And you cannot put hands on somebody or challenge them if that is not in the equation. So, DEA's never been accused of that, ever. Mm-hmm. But notwithstanding, there are significant portions of the population that lean that way. But you have to articulate all that in court. You can't just take action and not be able to articulate why you had this reason to engage someone.
And if it's just a question of race or gender, that won't work.
Never.
That won't work. Okay. Back to the phones. Jenneth has been waiting, and we've addressed the issue of legalization, but I think he wants to take it a step further, perhaps. Jenneth, go ahead. You're on the air with Ed Follis.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Very interesting conversation. I came up to the conclusion years ago that all drugs should be legal. You cannot stop people who want to take heroin, who want to take meth, who want to snort cocaine. You can't stop them. We have a huge drug problem with legal drugs in this country. Just because things are legal doesn't mean that people are going to do it. I mean, I don't drink alcohol. I don't smoke tobacco. I don't gamble. What I've seen with the drugs, there's so much money and so much corruption, and it seems like there's just been a war on young black men where they're caught with a couple of things of crack, and they're sent to prison. Their lives are destroyed. There's so much violence in the poor communities. Just because it's legal doesn't mean that people are going to try it. We tried it with alcohol. You see where that got us. You can't stop. If people want to destroy their lives, you can't stop them.
You know, I have to agree with you on that. But it's a secondary victimization that is so terrible. The drug plague around the globe produces so much money that, you know, terrorism, hostage taking, human trafficking, it's greatly subsidized by drug money. So I don't think the addict is the one ever to be pursued. It's those that enable everything. And you're right. The appetite's not leaving. If you watch Mr. Stone's movie Savages, you'll see that one of the points is, you know, all these people are being killed over this. I mean, Mexico lost 80,000 people, you know, in the last 8 years or 9 years.
But we're the market for this stuff. I mean, the United States is the market. If in fact it were legalized, this is the argument that those would propose legalization use. If in fact it were legalized, you'd be taking the money out of the hands of these people that we're talking about, these people that you've been dealing with all these years, and theoretically putting it in the hands of government, which would have more money to rebuild bridges and things like that.
You know, I spent some time in Amsterdam, and this is just a parallel. And, you know, there they have locations where people are able to take heroin and the more tragic drugs. And their addiction rate went through the roof. Now, look, I agree with the caller. He's right. People are going to satisfy their appetites no matter what, and they will find it whenever they want to find it. But there is, you know, a deterrent effect when you have to answer to the law. There really is. And, you know, I never grappled with somebody high on marijuana, but a lot of people high on alcohol, okay? So I think that there has to be stable minds that step in at the higher levels of government and say, okay, if we're going to regulate this and we're to allow it to be consumed legally, then, there has to be definitive measures taken. And I think, your caller is correct. But please understand me. Heroin, methamphetamine, coke, they steal your soul. I mean, I've seen hollowed out eyes. People just gone forever, and they can never get off. So, you know, the harder drugs, absolutely. Your caller is correct.
Let's return to the phones and bring in Roland, who wants to go back to the profiling issue, I believe. Go ahead, Roland. You're on the air.
Yeah. I just was talking to somebody, and I don't know all the metrics of it, but I'll just say this, that there are 20 to 30 tons of illicit drugs coming into the area every day, which a ton is about the size of a car. What I don't understand is why we consistently arrest five times as many African American people for usage when the usage by race is the same percentage of the population. We're creating this pipeline to prisons, to fund private prisons with blacks and Hispanics and minorities, yet the usage is the same with all races. And I don't understand that, and I'm looking to see if that can be, how he can justify that or how anybody can justify that.
Thanks, Roland.
Well, what occurs on the street is very sometimes. Look, I'll just tell you right now. In many cases, you get as much justice as you can pay for, and a lot of people are susceptible to earning a living, and they cheat. They take that bad course of life. And I don't know I wouldn't say that it's exclusive to a racial issue. It really is not, because I've arrested people from Thailand, Mexico, Afghanistan, Pakistan, all over the globe. And, you know, it's also a matter of consequences, you know, deciding, well, I'll get this job and I'll do this, or I'll sweep over there. Let me ask you, am I still speaking with him? Is he on there?
I don't believe he's there.
Okay.
No, he's gone.
All right. You know, if you could do me a favor, sir, listen to the song by Glenn Frey, Smuggler's Blues. That's what inspired me when I was a young boy to become a DEA agent. And it is the lure. It's the lure of wealth. And if you listen to that song, it articulates it very, very well. And, you know, it's a tough deal. I mean, it's like the deal you can't refuse when the money's there of that sorts. Legalization could not be properly regulated. It just can't. It just can't. I mean, you're going to have what? You're going to have the United States government, or, you know, the FDA and so forth, legalizing and selling heroin and meth and coke? Come on, man. It destroys lives. It destroys people.
I think what he's getting at, Ed, though, the fact that there is a disproportionate, he feels, a disproportionate number of African Americans who are jailed on drug charges than whites, even though the use is equal in percentage, in terms of percentage.
There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I cannot. And I wouldn't say anything other than, yes, he's right on that. It just seems sometimes that, you know, especially, you know, in law enforcement, they pursue that which is available. And I never did that. But, you know, I pursued the higher echelons. I don't think drugs should ever be a racial issue. Because you're right, there's as many Hispanics and whites and Asians and African Americans that take drugs. I think it's not a matter of profiling. I think it's a matter of opportunity.
It's an equal opportunity crime.
Yes, sir.
If you have the money to buy a drug and you're hooked, you're going to do it.
Yep.
Let's bring in Kathleen calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Hi. I just have a question and want his comments on, like, I feel like prescription medication in this country is becoming a huge problem, especially with young people, such as opiates and whatnot. And I was just wondering what the plan is and what the action is with the DEA and the government to, you know, solve this problem, because I just feel like it's always kind of put aside and no one deals with it, and just kind of want his comments on it.
Well, that's amazing that you brought that up. In Orange County, California, the major overdose drug that young people had consumed was oxycodone and hydrocodone and Vicodin. And DEA has a regulatory component to it. It's called the diversion component. And there, every single script that's written, you know, prescription by a doctor bears a DEA number. So you're absolutely correct. And DEA has really strongly come down on these pain management centers and these doctors that overprescribe, you know, like you said, opiates. But, you know, a lot of these doctors will just prescribe regardless, you know. And it's very dangerous because fundamentally those opiates that you're talking about, it's like high-grain heroin.
Correct.
You know, yeah. And people, you know, they get hooked on this stuff. I mean, you look at Heath Ledger. Look at these, you know, other people that are just hardworking, trying to make it, and they get addicted to pain management.
Rush Limbaugh comes to mind as one who's high profile in that regard. Time is beginning to slip away, and I wanted to get Roland back into the conversation. He's the one who you had a question for. Mm-hmm. Roland, thanks for being with us, but this has to be quick. Go ahead.
Well, long and short of it, the point I was making is we're dealing, these huge drug dealers are dealing in tons the size of cars, and yet we're busting people on the street with grams, mm-hmm. which is like less than an ounce. And there is a disproportionate arrest rate and conviction rate for blacks. And I am not in favor of legalization, but I'm just saying that the outcomes, you know, why can't you catch the car, the drugs the size of a car, rather than going after dealers on the street that are carrying grams and nickel bags?
Roland, thanks. Time's a factor here. Of course, that's what you spent a career doing, Ed Foles.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
I agree with you. The retail market is not where we should be obsessing upon. You're right. I think you're absolutely correct. We need to keep focusing on the sources, and like you said, ton quantities and so forth. Absolutely, that's where we should be. And you know, I take that position that we shouldn't be pursuing, you know, gram dealers on the street. Nope. What we do is the people that are addicted. We need to help rehabilitate and get their lives together.
And keep the drugs from even reaching that street corner or reaching the street. Yeah.
And that's what DEA does.
Yeah. Only a short time left. So Ed Foles, St. Louis, an UMSL graduate, by the way. We want to point that out. Very quickly, what did this undercover life of yours do to your personal life?
Not a very good one. Hmm. Yeah, you know. When you tell your spouse, or you, like my mom didn't even know what I did all these years, you know. And, you know, and then you come back to St. Louis and you're here and you're like, wow, this is reality. Here, you know. It deteriorated quite a bit of my life.
Were you married? Are you married?
No, I am not married. I was just divorced. Hmm. And I know without a doubt, you know, the vast majority of that was due to me being away all the time and the job. It's just, you know, you think about those guys in World War II that went away for 4 years and all they could do was send postcards to their wives, but it's a different world now.
Yeah. Well, I know you did lose some relationships as a result of your work.
I did. I lost
and
three.
That's all in the book. It's called The Dark Art. We have a minute left, and I do want to let folks know. I want them to read the book, number one, because it's a very interesting read. But number two, that this is leading to, you mentioned Oliver Stone a couple of moments ago. In less than a minute, you'll be working with him on what, a TV series on
this? Well, no. We're starting to assemble that series, and Mr. Stone has not agreed to do it yet. Mm-hmm. But you know,
but you have worked with him in the past.
Oh, yeah. And I would point out that the movie Savages is a spectacular movie, and if you're, you know, if your audience would want to watch that, they should, because he's just magnificent in every way.
Well, it would make a heck of a TV series, because we go from story to story to story to story all over the world, and it's just a fascinating life that you have lived, and we welcome you back to St. Louis, Ed Foles, to a different kind of life, but I'm sure you welcome it after all that you've been through all these many years. Congratulations on the book. We'll look forward to further word about you and Mr. Stone perhaps getting together on that television series. Ed Foles, the book is The Dark Art. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about a new study at Washington University that tracks the ability to remember U.S. presidents, and we'll talk about why that would be important. Then we'll take a look at Diversify Us, an app apparently and currently in development that seeks to connect people in unique and diverse ways. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.